From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
All right, right now we have a couple of members of the Stanford Graduate School of Business team. We have Senior Associate Dean Paul Oyer. He oversees the MBA program. He's professor of economics. He's also author of a new book, An Economist Goes to the Game. We'll talk about that in a moment. And Professor Kate Casey, Associate Professor of Political Economy. She worked for the World Bank. She worked for the government of Sierra Leone. Focuses, among other areas, of political accountability so much. But we want to talk to them because I think it has to do with the co-teaching model that often happens at Stanford. So we welcome them. First of all, thank you for having us on your campus. And it's great to kind of talk with the different constituents, if you will, of the Stanford community, including yourselves. Paul, let me ask you, first of all, you do oversee the MBA program.
I do.
What's top of mind when you think about what you want to make sure that the student body and the student population is getting here at Stanford?
Yeah, I think the students these days have so many demands on their time, and getting them to really take the 2 years that they're here and immerse themselves in the academic and the other things that the program has to offer, and not, you know, and really come here with a goal. I think that's a key to being successful. And then having great professors like Kate and so forth makes it easy for them to focus on academics a lot of the time, but there's just so many things you can do in 2 years at Stanford.
Well, talk about that a little bit, because I remember when I did go to business school a few years ago, and in our introduction, the dean, I remember saying, think about business school having three stools. One is academics, one is recruiting, and one is social. So whenever I was studying for a test, I'd always think to myself, am I doing more than 33% of the academics right now? Should I be out having beers with my classmates? How do you see that?
So first of all, just I would agree that those are the three legs of the stool. That doesn't mean they have to be equal legs. I like to remind people we're graduate school at Stanford University, which is the best research university in the world. Some of your listeners may disagree, but we're right up there no matter what.
Among the.
Well, number one according to the Bloomberg Business School.
Well, in business schools, in business schools for sure. So, and thank you for that, by the way. We appreciate it. Yeah, absolutely. There's the people who come here have already excelled in academics as undergrads and often with prior advanced degrees. So academics is very important. We would not be a part of Stanford University if we weren't providing that. Yes, those other things are really important. They're more important to some people than to others, and that's our job as faculty is to keep people focused on the academics and remind them that's what they're here for, and that's going to create value for them in their careers later on.
So I just want to know on that three-pronged stool, beer?
No, I over-indexed on academics.
That
because it was,
me.
I mean, I went kind of late. It was, you know, I had a lot of catching up to do.
All right, I just wanted to check. Yeah. All right, so Kate, let's bring you in on this because you, the political economy is so important. Mm-hmm. And I think about our world at large, whether, you know, war in Ukraine, Russia, supply chains, pushback against globalization. There's so much going on. The money influence in politics, which ultimately impacts the economy. What is it that you hope students who come here to get an MBA at Stanford, what they walk away with and what they think about when it comes to political economy?
Yeah, I mean, that's a brilliant question. So I think what's most important to think about is governments intervene in markets all the time, everywhere. There's not a country in the world that doesn't have, you know, different pieces of legislation, important regulatory changes, high-profile court cases that shapes the market environment, right? So you want to be able to understand how government works so you can make some reasonable forecasts about how policy might change, because those interventions, like, they create winners and losers, right? They impose direct costs, but they create opportunities. So the idea is to be able to anticipate policy and then reformulate your strategy in a proactive way.
If I can follow, in terms of the money in politics,
how
does that skew and make it so that maybe when it comes to the U.S. economy or the global economy, that we either get more out of it or we don't get as much as we could maybe get out of it if there wasn't so much money in politics?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to keep in mind that the U.S. is one system, right? So one advantage of, you know, allowing lobbying is that it's above board, it's on the table, you can regulate it and you can be transparent on it. But there's other models, like the U.K. has much less money in politics and more like state funding of campaigns and more of a level playing field. So I think it's, you know, important to look around and appreciate how different markets have different governance institutions.
Professor Casey, I'm wondering, from the students that you interact with, are you seeing a good portion of them go and work for governments, go into public service like you did earlier in your career? The reason I ask is because business school is expensive.
Yep.
And you need to cover those costs. And a lot of people do come to business school with the idea that they will leave earning in the top income bracket.
Right.
How do you reconcile those things?
Yeah, so I think those are important trade-offs, and obviously students have to find their own passion and their own pathway. One of the things that I've always found important, because I've worked, you know, for the World Bank and the government before, is that the skills that you get in an MBA program are incredibly valuable in running large public organizations. So we don't have a lot of students that go into government, but the ones that do, I think, are incredibly well equipped, you know, to run efficient, impactful organizations.
And
or then you have one that becomes the Prime Minister of the UK.
Exactly.
The flip side of that is you work for the government for a while, and then you go and you work for, you know, in the private sector, and you get paid handsomely for that.
Dean Oyer, come on in, because I want you to talk about the co-teaching model that happens here at Stanford. Tell us about it and how it helps students.
Right, so the foundation on which the academic side of the MBA program is built is we have faculty that are at the cutting edge. They're writing papers that are really leading their research fields. And we like to, we ask them to be very practical in their teaching. And sometimes a way to take that practicality to the next level is to actually find somebody from industry or some sort of practitioner to come in and co-teach with them. So I'll give you a couple of examples. There's a finance professor named Ilya Strebulaev who co-teaches two different classes, one on venture capital and one on private equity. He's teaching those with partners in those types of firms. Incredibly valuable courses. The students, the complementarities between the practitioner and the professor where, you know, Professor Strebulaev, Ilya will say, here's some of the, what the research shows on this and that. And then the partner will come in and say, well, okay, but let me add a little context on how it works in the real world. And then he'll say something about, we don't quite understand why that is. And then the professor will be like, well, let me give you a framework that, let me put that in the context of the so-and-so model that, that will help put a framework around that and give you some ideas. So I once co-taught a class that was with a guy who had been a partner at McKinsey. And it was that was a class about inequality, so it was a little more about public policy issues. And I'm a labor economist. I would bring in a lot of what the research said, and he would be like, you know, he was the top economic advisor to...
He'd be like, Paul, in reality...
Yeah. And he was the top economic advisor to Governor Newsom, and he would be like, okay, here's how we get these things done. Here's how we take that and get it done.
Is it 50-50 in scenarios like that? Are they in every classroom with you?
So the way things, the beauty of Stanford and like the blessing and the curse of Stanford is our courses are just really at the discretion of the professor. And so some of the team teaching will be like somebody will do 80% of the talking or really drive the discussion. Others will be 50-50, sometimes more the practitioner, sometimes more the lecturer. Some of our classes are case-based. Many of our classes are more experiential. Some will be even a little more traditional lecture, not very many of those anymore. So it really varies.
You know, it's interesting too, Kate, you know, you talked about political economy, political economics, and you're right, there's different models. When I was asking about money in politics, there's different models, US versus the UK. There's also, you know, we talk about the world and so often we're talking about the developed world. You do a lot of work in the developing world where great ideas come from, but there's also tensions. So tell us about how the importance of bringing the emerging economy into your teachings.
Yeah, so we try to have a very global perspective in the course. So, I mean, just to give you some examples, we look at political risk and oil and gas in Argentina. We looked at mobile money and how do you fit in with the central bank regulators in Nigeria. We looked at, you know, political risk around auto manufacturing in India, right? And then we look at U.S. healthcare reform. And we talk about, you know, money and politics. That was a huge part of it. So we tried to, I think the message is sort of twofold. One is a little bit of a sales pitch to look beyond the wealthiest countries for opportunities, if that's something you're interested in. And to recognize that if you think about the role of government, as you kind of move away from the wealthiest countries, the ability of the state to intervene in markets and really shape market opportunities, I think it's more amplified and even more important. So trying to be savvy, trying to understand who these regulators are, who's the politician, like why do they put themselves forward? What are they trying to achieve? What are their constraints? How does the firm fit in with that agenda or conflict with it?
We certainly spend a lot of time, Kay, talking about the challenges that this country faces when it comes to volatility in the markets, when we see high prices. We've also spent a lot of time in recent months talking about the challenges emerging economies face, specifically with a strengthening dollar and how they could be between a rock and a hard place if they have dollar-denominated debt. Yep. I'm wondering, in this kind of bizarre world that we're living in right now, to what extent you're worried about emerging economies being left behind, even more so than they have been historically, as a result of what's playing out in the global financial system?
Yeah, I think that's a great point, right? I mean, and it's incredibly challenging, and I think it speaks to, like, this is a truly globalized world now, and what happens in the U.S. and what happens in Europe affects every other country, right? And I think when you think about your ability to raise capital in one environment and bring it to bear in another, all of these things become extremely complicated.
Well, you know, when you think about what's really wonderful is in reading about Stanford and just the coverage that we've done over the years, you know, the experiences that students have, the experiential learning, that is such a big part of what you folks do. And I think about the real life events just this year, the crypto market. You know, Dinoyer, how do you guys incorporate that in? What comes up in conversations that ultimately may help you guys develop different courses you want to, you know, teach or different programs that you want to have here at Stanford?
Yeah, that's a great question. We're constant, the curriculum is a living thing. It's moving very quickly. And that's where the practitioners and the lecturers can be very helpful, because they can jump in and add topics in a way that the faculty, the academic research market is a little slower, we say, to develop. And so the topic,
especially some of the crypto, that if you think just in the last 6 to 12 months, what has happened.
Exactly. And the, you know, our now, having said that, our finance professors, of course, are adjusting and talking about crypto and the relevant contexts in their classes. So we do stay on top of that, and students ask for, oh, we want to learn about crypto, and we try to add courses or content around that. You know, the business school has to be a vibrant place, because we want to be very rigorous and academic, but we have to be relevant. We're trying to train people to go out and manage actual organizations, and they have to know, learn things in the context in which that's going to be done.
Metaverse? You can't laugh. You're in Silicon Valley. Can you laugh at the metaverse?
I think you can. I think it's allowable. Allow it.
We'll pass on that.
Dean, you're sitting on your book right now.
My God.
There it is.
How did that happen?
Goes to the
game. Oh, my goodness.
How to throw away $580 million and other surprising insights from the economics of sports. We have it there on the cover if you're watching us on the screen on QuickTake or at Bloomberg.com or on YouTube. How do you throw away $580 million?
Well, the title comes from the NBA strike, which was about 10 years ago now. And I'm a labor economist. There's one chapter that's all about why athletes get paid so much and why some have long-term contracts and some don't. And then there's a contract about collective bargaining agreements. And that's the example that's the labor economist in me. The book is about sports more generally. So like maybe one of my favorite parts is about the story of how you should think about whether or not to invest in your child's sporting career.
Yes.
Or why my favorite thing, to be honest, is this story about why Korean women are so great at golf, which when you think about it, is there's no good reason for that, but it's, at least to me, it's all economics. And you know, I turn on SportsCenter and I see economics. I'm a little weird that way.
Listen, we've done, you know, broadcasts from just before the Super Bowl. You know, we call it power players, because athletes have become so influential, the amount of money in sports, and now that gaming and gambling is getting much more involved. Just got about 40 seconds or so left. Final thoughts from you in terms of when you think about the importance of your students?
Yeah, I mean, this is like a gift to be able to interact with them and they're here. And what I love about them is they're very passionate and they're very ambitious and they go off in all kinds of different directions. And it's wonderful to see them flourish when they leave.
Dean Oyer, just about 20 seconds. What do you hope when a student comes here and gets an education? What do you hope they walk away with? One thing, very important.
I hope they come up with a broader view of what they can do to influence their organization and influence beyond their organization.
All right, we're going to leave it on that note. You guys, thank you so much. Really
thank
enjoyed
you.
This.
Thank
Good luck
you.
With the book.
Thanks a lot.
Senior Associate Dean Paul Oyer of Stanford, of course, and Professor Kate Casey, Associate Professor of Political Economy. Carol Masser, Tim Stenovic, this is Bloomberg.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
So we've talked with the dean of the Graduate School of Business here at Stanford. We've talked to some faculty, and now we've also talked to some famous alum, but we got to talk to the student body.
Oh, we've got a couple students here with us right now, two current students in Stanford's Graduate School of Business. We've got Charlotte Mierstadt joining us, as well as Cengiz Jamaloglu, both here with us at Bloomberg's, at our setup at Stanford's Graduate School of Business. You guys both have really interesting paths to getting here. Cengiz, you're from Turkey. Charlotte, you're from the Netherlands. Cengiz, I want to start with you and just getting into your journey and why you ended up choosing Stanford. Because when we do these rankings, I don't want to say we, because I actually have nothing to do with it.
I have nothing to do with it.
But we have a team at Business Week that does.
Yeah, I mean, Stanford's one of those schools that scores highest when it comes to compensation, networking, and entrepreneurship. So how do you think about those things when choosing a school?
Those are all quite important, but for me, actually, what was more important was what was going to grow me most as a person. What institution was going to make me the best version of myself that I can be and make me more introspective and be more attuned to what type of person I want to be, what type of leader I want to be. So I did anthropology and philosophy undergrad, actually, and worked a couple of years as an anthropologist, like kind of similar to being a journalist.
Worked here in the U.S.?
In Denmark, actually, okay. At a Danish consultancy firm. So going around and helping companies and governments and nonprofits get to understand the people around the world. So I would go and live with children or, you know, consumers of a particular product or citizens of a particular country and try to understand why they do what they do. And I did another year on venture capital. And coming out of that experience, I felt, hey, I don't really actually know. Why would anyone follow me? If I one day want to be a leader and want to build something and change something in the world, I need to better understand what are my strengths and how can I best use them so that other people feel also energized by the same causes that I feel energized about. So that's the reason I chose GSB, because Graduate School of Business at Stanford really has a big focus on that introspection element and teaching you the types of skill sets that will make you the best leader you can be.
I love that leadership. Charlotte, what's your story and that got you to here at Stanford?
Yes, so definitely a lot of what Cengiz shared resonates with me as well. My background is in arts and engineering, and I was working as an engineer in climate before business school, first on Hyperloop technology, and then at the Netherlands Aerospace Center on decarbonizing aviation. And in those roles, I noticed that even though I was enjoying the like challenge and content of engineering, my brain just always wanted to go like one level higher. Like, why would someone buy this? Aren't we just shifting emissions to another mode of transportation? Mm-hmm. What would be the policy implications of like doing something like this? What policy would have to happen? And I actually discovered that with my engineering background, I wasn't able to answer those questions. And at the same time, similar to Cengiz, I was also thinking a lot about would I want to start a company? Would I want to have a leadership role in a company?
Do you want to start companies?
I do, yeah. Me probably straight out of business school, yeah.
And me down the line.
Okay, so that's what's so interesting, because I mentioned this earlier, when I was in business school, one thing that I noticed about my classmates is that nobody goes to business school for self-discovery, to like kind of search for what they want to do. It seems like in order to be successful, you have to know what you want to do as soon as you get out, and you have to have your eye on the prize. So Charlotte, what did you want to do entering, and has that changed? And what are you going to do when you leave?
I think for me coming in, I was pretty focused on entrepreneurship. And then at the beginning of first year, just so much career options are thrown at you that I think I like briefly like expanded. But then during the summer, after I was like doing my internship, reflecting, I actually became very sure again that I do really want to start a company and that I'm very excited to just bring something into the world and like see whether I can build a team. And that just feels like a really great way to both go for environmental and human impact. Also because people spend so much time at work, like actually shaping a culture is something that feels like a very cool and challenging and exciting responsibility to me. And it's something we talk and think a lot about here at Stanford as well.
Chengiz, I want to go back to something you said about why, you know, getting your journey here, and you talked about the importance of leadership and learning leadership skills. When you think about leaders, I mean, there's a lot coming at them. Employees are looking at them for direction. There's pressure when it comes to big issues like climate change or wars or globalization. What are the role models that you kind of look up to in the business community?
Oh, there are so many, so many. I think one role model that I can look up to is Ray Dalio, for example. And the reason I would choose him is because of the principled nature of his leadership. I think one thing that Stanford Business School has shown me is that what great leaders have is a set of principles that they really care about, but at the same time, a flexible mind on allowing yourself to change those principles as you grow and learn more about yourself and more about the world. So that kind of conviction and firms that kind of conviction into a set of principles, but also willing to flex them and change them as you grow, I think is the type of value set that I aspire to have and look up to.
That was such a good question. I'm going to steal it and send it on over to Charlotte. What about you? Who and what do you look up to?
I think I've really changed my view on leadership since coming to Stanford. I think I came in seeing leaders as just having this one fixed style of leadership. And I've really come to appreciate range in leadership. That's something we work a lot on in the so-called experiential classes here at Stanford, where we will experiment with behaviors and leadership styles and get very direct feedback, action impact focused from our classmates. And what I think about as leadership now is actually having this toolkit, and Stanford has expanded my toolkit really greatly. Yeah. And basically having this whole range of different behaviors. And to me, like people who model that very adequately, I'd say, for example, like both of the Obamas show this spectrum between very collaborative, warm leadership, but also being able to set a very firm boundary. Right. Yeah.
Well, I wish we could talk more. We wish you good luck. We've got to run, but really great to check in with you. Really appreciate it. And wish you both so much luck going forward. Chengiz and Charlotte, thank you so much.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
So before we wrap up today, our special broadcast from the campus, we wanted to get to one more student who is actually she's a graduate, she's an alum, but she's tackling one of our biggest challenges of all time.
Yeah, Nicole Rojas is joining us. She's Stanford Graduate School of Business, class of 2022. She's the co-founder of a platform called Lasso. It's a company that's working to help farmers track their methane emissions. She joins us right now from Wisconsin. Nicole, good to have you with us this afternoon. Break down for us what Lasso does, because I think if you've been paying attention to what happens in terms of carbon emissions, we all know that the raising of cattle, the raising of beef, and what goes into agriculture is certainly a large contributor.
Yeah, Carol, Tim, it's so great to be here. So thank you for having me on. At the end of the day, what Lasso does is it makes a business case for on-farm emissions reductions. If you're a business or a farm and you want to implement a new practice, it has to make financial sense. And in order to make financial sense, you have to have data to back up showing that you're doing what you say you're doing, whether it's to back up, you know, claims that you're making on your brand or to apply for external funding. And today it's, to get this data, it's really manual, you know, lots of phone calls, farm visits, fragmented Excel spreadsheets. So what Lasso does is automates this largely manual process to make financial sense for the beef and dairy companies, as well as the dairy farmers and beef ranchers.
And you're coming to us today from Wisconsin, right? We see a lot of dairy farming, obviously, there. Tell us about kind of your personal experience of growing up in the area and how that impacted what you wanted to do, you know, ultimately today.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm originally from Green Bay, Wisconsin, so I'm a proud cheesehead. Happy to be here now, although I'm trying to stay warm.
I knew that was coming.
But, you know, for me, going into this space, it was this fantastic intersection of this industry that's near and dear to my heart as a proud Wisconsinite, but also that has a profound impact on the climate. And what's really exciting about agriculture and working in sustainability here is that we really see it's a win-win. It's both for environmental sustainability and improving the land that we're farming on and the cattle that we're working with, but also financial sustainability, that by doing these emission reduction practices, it's improving the financial viability of these farms.
Well, it's funny when I think about ESG, right? And ESG, Tim and I talk a lot about it going through a reckoning. But I think initially the thinking was, what was the financial impact that climate change was going to have on industries and companies? You know, we know the importance of saving the climate to make sure that we're all around in the future. But that financial, you know, using the data to kind of understand financially how climate change is impacting financially, again, various companies. And I feel like that speaks to what you guys are doing, that you're using the data to kind of get an understanding.
Absolutely. And more than ever now, it makes financial sense. Whether you see government support, like the USDA Smart Commodities bill that's, you know, or the grants is $3 billion that's distributed to both farmers and companies alike to support these emissions reduction projects, or even the Inflation Reduction Act that was passed recently that set aside $20 billion for emissions reduction in agriculture. There has never been a better time to address emissions on cattle farms today.
Nicole, take us into the origin story of how you did this while you were a student at Stanford. I think a lot of people who've gone to business school would argue you don't really have much extra time if you're focused on academics, if you're focused on networking, focused on the social aspect and on recruiting, of course. So how do you do this while you're a student?
Yeah, so the number one reason I came to Stanford GSB was to work in climate tech and understand what a career in climate tech looked like. Stanford GSB, both inside the classroom and outside the classroom, made this a reality. So for me, for example, there's a course called Stanford Climate Ventures. That's a project-based entrepreneurial course where you can narrow down your idea and refine what's the problem you're really trying to solve there. In classes like Startup Garage as well, that really was crucial for us in answering some of the tough questions on what's willingness to pay look like? What's the market size? Who is specifically your customer? Questions that we needed to answer before we started fundraising for our pre-seed round. And so, yes, I was working on this outside of class, but at Stanford GSB, there are courses that allow you to really focus in on what you're trying to build and what you're trying to pursue.
You know, and it's funny because one of the things that we've talked about with the faculty here and the dean is the idea of experiential learning. And how did you tap into that when you were at Stanford?
Yeah, so I can think of three core buckets. I already mentioned the first one, which is Stanford Climate Ventures. Startup Garage as well, I mentioned that. There were additional classes, though, that were more case-based, where you learned from entrepreneurs who or business leaders who had to deal with similar issues that you might experience. So, for example, in my Managing Growing Enterprises class, we had Whitney Wolfhard come to class, and she talked about some issues she had when she was starting Bumble. And to me, to learn from inspirations for me and take those learnings into my own startup is really what I would call part of that experiential learning.
What about when it came to raising money? I mean, have you raised money for Lasso? But I know that Stanford alumni who've gone on to start companies have actually tapped advisors or lecturers that they've had for seed funding rounds. Talk to us about the fundraising process.
Yeah, it was such a learning process, but I, again, couldn't have been at a better place to answer all of my many questions of going through fundraising for the first time. Whether it was our Startup Garage advisor, Harpy Singh, or the Center for Entrepreneurial Studies with Deb Whitman to answer questions on term sheets, our pitch deck, give us feedback there. That was incredibly helpful. And then all the way to where it all started with that Stanford Climate Ventures, one of the professors, Jane Woodward, is our one of our angel investors. And, you know, just the resources there and being in this environment just made a huge difference for someone as a first-time founder and first-time fundraising.
Nicole, last question, just got about 30 seconds. Where do you want to take the company or what's your next step here? And I'm just curious if you've got other companies, bigger companies, maybe publicly held companies circulating around you saying, we want to work with you.
Yes, I can't say the name yet, but really excited when we finally can. We're starting working with the U.S. dairy brand to help them tackle emissions in their supply chain of farmers. So we're so excited to be starting with that this month with my amazing co-founder, David Pardavi. And we're bringing on our first set of hires with a software engineer and customer success manager. So excited to get this off the ground and work with both farmers and dairy brands at this point.
Well, when you're ready to break the news, feel free to come find us out. We'd love to talk to you more with it. Nicole, thank you so much. Good luck with it. Nicole Rojas, Stanford Graduate School Class of 2022 and the co-founder of Lasso.
That's a wrap.
Almost. And it's still raining.
That's good. The state needs it.
I know the state needs it. Really fun. We love coming to Stanford. As we said, Bloomberg Business Week ranking it for the fourth year in a row, the number one graduate school of business, but great to check in with the community.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.